I'm Horace Dedu. I am with Asymcote. And today I'm panicked about Apple earnings.
Jensen.
Hello, Mr. Lindsay.
Hello, Lindsay.
Should we be formal now and just call each other Mr. Jensen or Mr. Lindsay from now on?
Who signs the check?
You don't. So I'll call you
whatever the fuck you want. I can't fire you.
Exactly.
Hang on, quiet. Just heard a nose hair grow.
Oh.
We're in the quiet room where the only thing growing is on my back. For you younger people, it's going to happen. Hair will start growing in places you don't want to go. Resist the urge to shave. I mean, I started doing this in my 30s. It's like I'm a gardener. It's like all I do. Ring, ring, ring. I have a manscape. It's on like a pull cord that I have to. I have such a big blade on it that it's like a Toro machine. I have to. Well, and here's me like cranking.
Sounds dangerous. That puts you in an ER.
Yeah, and
now
the worst part is it's gross. Like no one should have to look at me, including myself. And is this an investing show that we're doing? No one should have to see me, including myself. But what's weird is if there was a camera in my house, Knut, if, I'm not saying the Russians should do that, but if they wanted to have a really good time, the Russians, and just play stuff back, there wouldn't be a pee tape because I hardly pee because of my prostate, but there would be a Manscaped tape going around. And what's really weird is when I cut myself a little bit under my boob or on my back, I mean, what that must look like to my poor, like, to anybody that has seen me naked.
You know,
this is why when I go to the club at Silver Lake, I shower in all my clothes.
I guarantee you it's enough to not watch any video because the visual I have in my head right now.
Right, isn't a visual, but that is the visual. Imagine that. That's right. What's happening. This is why Trump had to kill the pee tape.
Right.
All right. Anyways, I think we've run out of time, and our guest laughed when he heard that opening. So, hate to dumb down the opening, but we have one of the smartest people that I don't know, but I'm a huge fan of, that I got the courage to ask onto the show. He is dialing in from Spain, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And he is from Romania?
He's from Romania, U.S. citizen, lives in Finland, and is now in Spain.
Yeah, so it's like being in Texas, going to Oklahoma, stopping in North Dakota, and then being in New Mexico. What do you think?
Very close.
Yeah, see the way I do things? So, anyways, Horace Dedu, Horace Dedu is really one of my favorite follows. Now, the reason I started following him, maybe through Ben Thompson or Tech Meme, this is old school people, is everybody linked to him. And then I discovered him. That's how the internet works, people. Now it just works with emojis and laughing at people and starting fights. But back in the old days, when people tried to get smart, we linked and we shared and we discovered. And I luckily discovered Horace. And I'm not sure where he was living at the time, but he understood Apple. I understood Apple from walking into a store, Knut, and saying, motherfucker, like, I'm wearing these headphones. A billion other people are going to be wearing these headphones. Horace, on the other hand, did work, actual work, and studied the company. He came from the software computing business, I'm sure. We'll dig into that. And now runs one of the best, you know, I think, Twitter streams and podcast arms around micro mobility, but forever was writing about Apple. And it always helped me stay with Apple, even though he was never talking about the stock. He was always talking about what made Apple great and just laying out the numbers in ways that just always blew my mind. And obviously, Apple was the company that was creating those numbers that blew my mind, but Horace had a way to stay with that company. So I want to check in on that, the good, the bad, the ugly of Apple strategy, and then this world of micro mobility, which is an incredible focus of it. He's got great podcasts. I'll link to everything at the end. But if you like smart people and like stuff that actually will help you make money, even though he's not talking about stocks and how to make money, Horace will be your man. Let's get him on the phone.
Sounds good.
You're on.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Super excited being here. And of course,
what a thrill this must be for you.
I follow you all the time. I read everything you write. So, yeah, it's an honor.
Are you the one sending me things about my grammatical errors? Or are you leaving me alone?
Anonymously, yeah.
See, now, right away, I go, Romanians don't use... Like, Ivanhoe's one of my best friends and never laughed at my joke. And meanwhile, the Romanians, right away, laughing. What is it about Romanians versus Bulgarians that you guys get the joke and Bulgarians just always are upset?
Well, I don't want to get into that, but I'll say this one thing. I mean, Romanians tend to be more Latin-based, and we tend to get more of the sort of, Mediterranean lifestyle kind of jokes, maybe. But yeah, no.
See, there has to be something to that. Do you hear that laugh? Like, Ivanhoe's one of the smartest people I know. Can't get him to crack a smile, which is part of his charm as a Bulgarian. But I wouldn't fix him up with my sister. Whereas a Romanian, take my sister. So you're in Spain. What's happening in Spain? Vacation or staycation or COVID?
No, just vacation. Family is in Finland, typically. And so for Europeans, Spain is like Florida.
Right.
So you've got your snowbirds, you know, mostly older people who come for the sun and the climate. So, yeah, that's very typical to make a like spring break in Spain from Finland.
So tell people what you do, because for most people, while I'll link, I just want people to have a background of yourself.
So for at least 10 years, this is about 2009 until about 2020, I was mostly dedicated to writing about the mobile industry in the form of my pod. There was a podcast called The Critical Path. There was a blog platform called Asimco and my Twitter account at Asimco. And what I was doing there was deconstructing Apple and through Apple, looking at the entire tech space and trying to figure out what's relevant, what's the future going to be, and not directly, as you said, making calls on the stock price, but mostly saying, where we're going strategically. And so I did that for about 10 years. And then I also kind of forked into doing micromobility, got really passionate about it in 2018. I coined the term micromobility. I created a conference. I created another podcast, another newsletter, another blogging platform. And now also I joined as a partner Relay Ventures to help with strategy there as well.
Up in Canada, Relay?
Yeah, Canadian, BC.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so that's what I've been doing more in the last 2-3 years is looking more at micromobility. As I said, this is something I'm very passionate about, but I haven't given up looking at Apple. I think in many ways, actually, the two are going to eventually merge. The future of transportation and computation is going to be a very interesting area, and it's not necessarily all cars. In fact, I'm betting it's not all cars. And so, and to the extent that the tech companies that we know of today, the big five, the Microsoft and the Google and the Amazon and all of those platform companies, to what extent they're going to participate in being mobility in the sense of transportation, that's fascinating to me. And I know, I've studied all the data, how many hours we spend in our cars, how many miles, how much money we spend, and how far we go, and all these metrics, because when you compare that with how much time we spend on our devices, and you ask this question, like before devices existed, how much time we spent on our computers and how much time we spent on our TV and our consumer electronics and all these things. And we only have 24 hours a day. That is a finite budget. We have to sleep some of that. So when you start to, slice and dice all the time in the world and all the people, there's going to be a fight for attention and a fight for our time. And I really believe that transport is currently about an hour a day, could stretch a little bit further, not much more, but that's up for grabs right now. And that is going to become a big fight. So in any way, that's a long answer to your question, but I this is only to justify having my hands in two different pots, if you will.
Relay Montreal, right? I'm trying to think. I know the guys, Cornway. Is Relay Montreal?
Toronto, I think.
Toronto.
Actually, I haven't even been there yet because of COVID.
what got you so fascinated with writing about Apple for so long, so focused and so right? What was it about Apple that just...
Oh, that's a great story, because I was at Nokia. So right. for 10 years prior to Asimco, so we're talking 2001 till about 2009.
Knut's all horny. He loves Nokia. Yeah.
Used to.
I went to Finland. By the way, I fell in love with Finland. I fell in love with Nokia early on in, like I said, in 2000, 2001, because I love the idea of mobile phones in your, you know, the power they had, I studied computer science. I studied computer engineering. Mm-hmm. I got an MBA. Now, all of this happened in the US. And then right around late 90s, I was saying, well, we're all going to have pocket sized computers, but it was like not happening fast enough. So I got impatient. And, I started talking to European companies, and Nokia in particular was up and rising. And I said, this is the platform of the future for, and we're talking 90s right now.
Yeah.
So I said, we're all going to have these things in our, you know, that was pretty clear. We're going to have the voice product, but whether we're going to have a computing product, that was a very tall order.
Correct.
And so I went to Nokia specifically to think about how to not just bring computing, but to bring media. I actually joined an internal venture. So we're going to do media distribution. That was the name of the group, media distribution inside Nokia. This was happening in 2001. I met my wife, in fact, in a joint project with a publishing company in Finland where she worked. And there were the newspapers and the magazines and the books industry of Finland. And you know, we did a joint project.
And she's Finnish?
She is Finnish, yes.
Yeah,
and we
it.
Did this joint project where we were trying to figure out how people would read. This is 2001. 9/11 just happened.
Yeah.
We're delivering onto these phone call communicators, which are these like clamshell type phones
sure.
that had a very wide screen, but a very short screen. And so we're delivering onto these devices, the news and the magazine articles and short videos and things like this. And this was 2001. And I said, you know, someday this is going to be big. And
sucker.
And so I'm inside Nokia for that period of time where we're going to project all this going forward, and we're going to make smartphones for everybody. Billions and billions of people. We had 1 billion customers in 2004.
Wow.
Not smartphones, just regular phones.
Sure.
And we're going to, you know,
that ring, that Nokia ring. It's
yeah.
still, it's like the AOL ring, that Nokia. What was that phone that was the most popular? The 80?
3160, something
the
3160.
Like that. 3160. What a ring. Like what that. A ring that had.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was exactly. It was an icon. And I, you know, we were moving slowly towards making these smarter with something called Symbian, the operating
sure.
system. We're looking to bring apps. We had apps, actually. We had an app store. We had all of those things in 2002, 3, 4, and 5. And, you know, by 2005, I was getting a little bit worried because the ramp wasn't as fast as we predicted. By then, I started actually being an internal analyst looking at the competitive landscape, because Microsoft was breathing down our neck. Microsoft with its so-called pocket PC, which was actually a PDA, and they moved the PDA into a competitor to BlackBerry and Palm OS, and into a competitor to the phone business by adding a cellular circuit to a PDA. And eventually they were going to come into this space, and everybody thought it would develop like the PC industry would, which would be Microsoft owning the OS, and maybe Intel or someone else, maybe Qualcomm would own the chipset, and then a Nokia would be nothing more than a Dell or an HP, which would be low margin PC margins and not a very attractive business to be in.
Right.
And so, and with a lot of competition, obviously. So the fight was over the heart and mind of the computing phones. And that's where it became like, you know, this confrontation between Nokia and Microsoft. And I was in the middle of that, trying to project and advise management on our strategy. And I was coming from computing. So I said, guys, be really careful, because they really have this domination strategy, and they're very, very aggressive. And, you know, this was still Bill Gates running the show. And,
yep.
Ballmer was starting to take over, but it was very, very, like they were still very, very hungry. And so into that came Apple with something called the iPod. And I was, as an analyst, you also, as a student of Clay Christensen, by the way, because that's what I studied you know, when I did my MBA in the mid-90s, I actually went to Harvard Business School and I studied with the great late Clayton Christensen. And, you know, he had put his book out in 98 on disruption. That was the innovator's dilemma. And that was pretty much defined my generation as far as the, you know, the strategy for technology is concerned. And I you know, took that Bible with me. That became my Bible. And I took it to management. I said, you know, Apple's got a lot of the attributes here for being an entrant that can do amazing things with this iPod, because it could develop into a phone, and they got hearts and minds with you know, the industry and their brand and everything else. But it was dismissed. It was classic innovator's dilemma, because they said, you know,
not me. That was and for me, that moment was walking into a store at the Biltmore in Phoenix and seeing the iPod. It wasn't even just the iPod. It was the store that framed the iPod that I knew it.
Yeah. Everything they did was contrary to what we also learned, again, from the Microsoft era, which was that you got to, you know, Microsoft had Zune and had Place for Sure, which was their media platform. It had their own DRM. They had all these pieces, and they wanted to partner with all these players that would somehow build, you know, different music devices with different you know, user interfaces and all these other things. And Apple came in, no, it's one thing, it's simple. There's only one store. There's only one way to get music into your device. There's only one way to protect it. And so when Nokia was educated by the PC era, as were other players like Google was the same way, you know, they said, we're going to go modular. We're going to provide an OS and work with partners. And that's how we're going to build an ecosystem. Microsoft was like, no, we're going to focus on the user experience. And that's when I looked at that and I said, you know, this is very, very asymmetric. ASIMCO, by the way, stands for asymmetric competition.
Got it.
And I said, they're coming at it orthogonal. This is David Goliath's stuff.
Right. You know? They said, twisted it back to they twisted it back to all-in-one. That was a bold listen, because gateway stores, like all these computer stores fail, CompUSA, and then the Apple store. I mean, it was just so many things that they got right.
Yeah,
it was a big bang moment, because it wasn't the phone. It was the little iPod. It was magical, magical, magical from how they displayed it.
The iPod, the ear pods, the store that was plugged into it initially was just Mac only, because you got FireWire connection, but it was the retail experience. Everything was integrated. And those were glory days.
And
it just looked so different than what the dogma of the day was. The sort of and even after this, we're talking early, like 2004 till 2007, and Apple was just killing it with the iPod. Yeah. And then 2007, the iPhone comes, and 2008, the iPad comes.
No,
and,
but also remember desktop. We were locked in a Microsoft world, in the finance world. We had to do everything like crap, you know what I mean? And download software to trade and blah, blah, blah. And then they force guys like me to just move everything to the internet, because we wanted a piece of beautiful, simple software. And, and eventually everybody built stuff for trading. Because remember, trading world was all Microsoft world.
Yep. Yeah. And the Mac was traditionally kind of like, you know,
very narrow,
a very tiny market share. But my thinking was, because I was inside the company at the time, inside Nokia, and I was like trying to explain how it was possible for someone to be an entrant and to come in and actually, quote unquote, disrupt an incumbent ecosystem and everybody, you know, and not just Microsoft, but also potentially Nokia, potentially Motorola and
BlackBerry.
BlackBerry, who were actually very dominant at the time in the US.
Sure.
And I try to present this possibility, and it was something that people didn't buy at all. I mean, there was no. And I actually made myself an Apple analyst. I was not working. I was not supposed to be doing that. I was supposed to follow, like I said, other two legitimate competitors. I was supposed to follow Microsoft. I was supposed to follow this and write all these reports and explain how, you know, PowerPoints and all this stuff about how they're going to either succeed or fail. And I was like, not particularly passionate that you know, that story would be the one. Because the difference for me as an analyst is like I really get excited about some ideas and I will not let go. And so I just have no interest in working within the confines that were defined for me. So I eventually left. But during this process, I was practicing this idea of storytelling. And there's one small detail here, because it's a Finnish company. I'm a sort of a U.S. citizen, but not native U.S. But I had to speak a language that they could understand, and I began to do so with graphs and data, because that was a language that was universal. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the other thing I was constrained by was PowerPoint was the only way people really communicated. They probably still do. But it was like, okay, what do you put on a slide that gets the message across? And the thing was, I kind of made this visual language for myself. I said, I can't use as, let me use as few words as possible. Let me try to make it all visual. And so I honed my skills at the displaying visual information and data. So that means mostly charts and graphs. And I took that into online. And that's where my experience of blogging began, which is like, you know, copy pasting these graphs together with some words. And the narrative was very going to be very much kind of like storytelling, but the visuals were where you anchor on the credibility. And so this is where I transitioned from being an internal analyst slash advisor to a big company. To once I left, people told me, "Why don't you keep doing that? We were enjoying reading your stuff inside." And so that's how it all started as a blogging. So and again,
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, it's just I want to make this small anecdote because people often say, "Well, you just reach a state of fame instantly," but it wasn't that at all. It was because I had become passionate about something, and I had become, you know, using a visual language and a certain style and found a voice and then practice. And then John Gruber, who's a great, famous,
the best, one of the best
Apple commentator, he actually linked to my stuff. And that actually caused my
that was
my
your big bang.
Is that, yeah. He
For
he,
me, it was Seth Godin. And when he linked to me, I go, you know what? I'm not bad.
Yeah, yeah. The early days of you know, it seems like not so long ago, but it was early days, I guess, for the internet and people really... It was a community where people really linked to each other, but because they were finding really worthwhile material.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how I got into Apple, is because I was really curious about that anomaly in terms of the way they approached the problem of technology marketing and development. And I had been schooled in Nokia. I had been schooled in other companies in the 90s, which I worked at what is now Verizon. It used to be GT Laboratories. I worked at Chase Manhattan, which was a huge bank at the time in New York. I went to business school and got trained up before the dot-com era about, you know, how to properly supposedly run a business. And here comes Apple, and it was a really weird company compared to all of this learning I had. And I was fascinated by it. And also as an engineer, I really love the products. And so that's how I became a commentator on it. It wasn't something I was ever paid to do. And so I dug in and eventually developed what I might call a theory of the company. What are its primary, you know, priorities? I was fortunate that eventually they got a hold of me, they being Apple, invited me to their events. And so I had some, you know, privileged, you know, at least access to their public persona, but I was there, you know, in the audience at their launch events. And so I got to see it up front as well and got to talk to a few people. You know, they don't tell you much. Right. They have very, very,
it was so
very careful. But you, there's something about the, you know, when you're face to face with some people and you may hint at something and you see their facial reaction. Sometimes you get a hint of what's going on. And sometimes they just smile and sometimes they just nod, but you get a sense of kind of how, maybe a little bit how they think. But anyway, so I was able to get that access, but I also was able to really deeply think about nothing else for about 10 years. And I really felt I kind of cracked that puzzle. In some degree, the reason I'm not doing as much anymore of that is because I felt that there wasn't much more to learn. There, I really understood Apple as best as perhaps anyone could. And I'm just sitting back now, seeing the movie play, and it's a movie that I would have predicted some time ago. I mean, the services story I was talking about 6-7 years ago. Yeah. And this is why also I got into mobility, or I should say transportation, because in 2014, rumors about Apple Car started, and I said, I better get smart on this. By then, I joined the Christensen Institute as a researcher, as a fellow. And while I'm working with the man himself, and I said, let's write a book about the future of transportation. I think this is going to be big. This is 2015. And And I said, before we do that, I need to bone up on cars and everything to do with transportation. And I dug into it for 3 years. And then at the end, I said, you know, none of the stuff I see with this, these were the candidates back in 14, 15, self-driving and car sharing, which is Uber, et cetera. Then there was going to be what you'll call case communications, autonomy, sharing, and electric. And so this is the acronym CASE. And everybody said, okay, these are the big four vectors for disruptive change, the technologies that are going to change automobility and change everything. And I looked at all of these using the lens of disruption theory, using all the knowledge I had about the phone business, the compute business, the software business. I said, you know, none of these are going to pan out. Not one of them. It, you know, either in the case of electric, it's sustaining. Everybody's going to want to do it. In the case of sharing, it's not profitable. In the case of communications, it's a commodity. And in the case of autonomy, we're probably looking at 15, 20, 30 years. And it's not going to happen fast enough. So I drew a blank. I said, this is bad. We don't have a book. And so it all changed. I say, this is kind of the birth of micromobility story. The origin of it was that I took a ride on an e-bike. And at that moment, in 20 minutes, it undid 3 years worth of analysis, because I said, we've just been measuring the wrong thing. We've been measuring cars. We've been looking at that data. We should be looking at the data of everything else. And then you start to look for that data, and there isn't any. There's just none. And actually, the thing that sparked micromobility is, like I said, we have to find a way to measure this phenomenon of non-car transportation. The small is beautiful, the micro, the everything else. And the word came to me as micromobility, very similar to the way the microcomputer was used as a term of art for the PC early on. And microcomputer versus mini computer versus mainframe. So that was the epiphany I had between 2015 and 17. And after that, I decided to sort of start my own company to do something about it.
And so, an incredible arc. I think the lessons here, obviously, some people always say, how are you know so much about the markets? And I'm like, yeah, tried studying it for 30 years. And it's like, you're writing, someone will show up today off a link and they go, oh, yeah, he's good. And I'm like, you got to go back. Like, you can't appreciate that era. Because in the opening, I was talking about links and how we used to do this stuff. The way we were, it was kind of more brotherly. And I'm sure the people, the utes on TikTok are thinking they're linkers and helping each other. But it was something about that early technology web where we were all just, we all didn't know, but I sure knew with Apple. I sure knew. And guys like you helped me stay with it. Question about that. Knowing what you know, did you ever buy the stock?
I did, actually, and I bought early enough to prosper from that. And my interest was, you know, I don't trade. I don't buy and sell. I buy and hold. And I did the buying in around 2008, 9, and 10. And that's it.
But not, you didn't know enough or have any money to do it in 04, 5, and 6. You didn't know.
I spent it on other things, mostly real estate, but it was mostly because I needed a place to stay.
Sure.
But it's just that I think it does a good job reinvesting, you know, through this stock purchase, and maybe I did buy dribs and drabs here and there, retirement accounts, things like that. It wasn't I just watched it grow, and it split and split again, and you know, I'm very cautious. I'm not a trader. I'm actually kind of risk averse when it comes to my own funds. And so I also don't know, frankly. I've seen the bottom fall out of Apple multiple times. I kind of watched for, you know, 20% is a bear, supposedly, market. But, yeah. You know, I've seen Apple fall 40%.
Right.
And shook my head because I knew this was an amazing company. And I saw it drop. The worst was in 2008 when literally the iPhone was just going straight up. Some people may remember this, but this was a seminal moment. During the fall of 2008,
Was it the options thing when they went off jobs, or was it just the market crisis?
There was a market crisis, and so every stock was falling. And during that quarter, I think it's the fall of 2008, during that quarter, Apple overtook BlackBerry for the first time in sales. I mean, the iPhone did. The iPhone overtook the BlackBerry, and Steve Jobs came on the conference call. He never used to participate in the conference calls. It was still Tim Cook back then and the CFO who took the questions. But he came on and almost pleaded and almost begged people to have faith in Apple because they were doing really, really well with the iPhone. But the stock kept going. In fact, it probably accelerated once he came on the call because people were just so panicky. And actually, I think I bought a few at that moment. But when I see the market just running off a cliff while the company is going straight up like a rocket, when you see moments like that, you know, they're very rare. I think Warren Buffett is on the record of saying kind of that's when you buy, when there's blood in the streets. But I've seen multiple cases where there was an earnings warning once under Tim Cook where you know, China had a bit of a hiccup and then, you know, the stock tanks 20%. And maybe other stocks have similar profiles. But in the case of Apple, I knew there was a very reliable company as far as its potential, as far as its earnings. And I just shook my head when that was happening. And I wouldn't say, again, that traded or anything. I just held. And I wrote about it a bit. You know, the fact that it was having a P ratio below 15, below 10 even occasionally, while it was growing, while it was actually accelerating growth. And the stock price effectively said, we're throwing this company away. This is garbage.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that was just hardware companies before them. And I think when you started writing about the services business, it gave me, like, I don't know if they were listening to you or you just got inklings that they understood to get their multiple higher, but they started to do it. So the question is, as you move on to micromobility and bicycles, like you were in Nokia, you've been around the block. What is there? Is there a blind spot? I don't know how you stop it.
Yeah, I'm spending more than half my time thinking about exactly this question, and I get this a lot, is like, what would cause you to lose faith in this? And my thesis is, again, it's mostly a cultural thesis. What I see the company now as doing is not the iPhone company. It's not even the integrated or the experiences company, which a lot of people try to synthesize and saying Apple is really at the bottom of it all. You know, about making great experiences, or it's a great design company, or it's a great product company, or it's this and that. No, no, no. It's culture. The thing that captures it best is stay hungry, stay foolish. That phrase that Steve Jobs stole from the Whole Earth catalog, a very kind of new age era type of thinking. And there's a sense of humility. There's a sense of hunger. There's a sense of, as I said, being the underdog and being never satisfied. And that hunger is what you worry about losing the most. And it's very easy to do that. Humility is very, very easy to lose. And if you lose it, it's very hard to gain it back. And so what I study carefully is whether the company falls into this human trap, this human nature trap of kind of, well, we figured it out. We're satisfied. Now we can be a little bit arrogant. We can be a little bit more, let's say, you know, comfortable. And that's really what undoes great companies at the end of the day. And I think that this disruption, as I say it, is humility as a business model.
I love that.
Let's see if we can bottle humility and make a killing with it. And no one does this because they think most Western world companies think humility is bad. And you need to be arrogant. You need to say that you're better than anyone else. And no, you should say, I am actually not very good and I will strive to get better. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for them not to lose this. And I think at least under the management of Tim Cook, they've been maintaining that ethos. And it's always in danger of being corroded and undermined. So that's my biggest worry.
Yeah, that humility, America loves parts, so they have to be careful. Like, I know internally when I hear the blogosphere go after them because maybe the employees don't have humility anymore just because of the woke world or the left or the right, but they have managed to survive that humility. What did you call humility as a
business model?
Yeah, it's genius. Listen, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I goof off? And it's just like, man, luckily I'm wired this way, but I don't want to I mean, I had plenty of ego in my 20s. It didn't get me very far, and I kind of didn't like myself then. You know, I opened with talking about shaving and this. I mean, people, we all do this stuff the same way, and companies have the same problems all the way around. And when I see these brands blow up.
It's a human condition. You know, I studied engineering. My parents were mathematicians. I came from a culture of, you know, everything had to be calculated and supported by evidence. So I never really got into the soft subjects, except maybe, you know, in terms of like music and art. So I didn't really have, like, one thing I regret is not having taken psychology in school or not having taken sociology. And, like, you know, as an engineer, these were considered soft subjects that were like for people who had didn't have the ambition and all that. But when as I got older, I just realized that if you want to get into the world of business, you have to understand the human condition. And the human condition is fundamentally intractable, and it's not going to be something you can calculate. But even if you're an introvert, even if you're not a people person, you have to develop a sensitivity to how humans think. And it might be an asset to be analytical. It might be so that you actually stand apart from the problem you're trying to solve and think about it deeply. And that's what I try to do. And yet, you know, you have to have a lot of heart. And that's the problem, I think, fundamentally for people in my, let's say if I'm speaking to a 20-year-old version of myself, the advice I would give is like, you should focus on the data, understand all that, but also think about poetry. You also should think about the arts. You should think about humans as the fundamental decision on what you will do in life. And that's really at the, you know, Steve Jobs said his best, you know, Apple sits at the intersection of the humanities and, or he said the liberal arts and engineering, or you could say humanities if you wish. But the idea of that they're a bit of both. And that to me is the magic. And that's what I try to also achieve. There are great people who are in the humanities who understand no engineering. There are great people in engineering who understand nothing about humanities, but it's good to have a bit of both. That's what I try to figure out. And again, you only have so much time. I wish I could do this for every company in the world. And then I would be so smart and would be able to give advice on all these other companies. And sometimes people turn to me and say, well, what do you think about this or that? I said, well, I haven't had 30 years to think about this other company. I've only had, you know, enough time to think about one.
Luckily, you picked a good company. Yeah, lucky you didn't pick Twitter to do this over. You might have killed yourself. But you picked the right one. And I see, and I, you know, this is why we probably appreciate each other's work is, all I think about is humility. All I think about is like, what does the other person, not think of me, because you can't win everybody over. But like, really, when I go home, it's like my kids read the blog, my wife reads the blog, I make mistakes. But like, I'm not afraid for my friends to say, dude, tone it down. You know, I expect my friends who read me to tell me when I'm out of line, because I want to bring it back in. Like, I don't want to cross the line. And not enough people ask their audience to tell them or their fans to say, let me know, you know.
Yeah.
When Robinhood was going through their thing this summer and they just forgot to show the humility side of it. And but whatever brands hurt themselves, it's always in how they handle that moment of humility. And you're right. The reason Apple's been able to pull this off is they've the culture side. They've just managed to be American without being the worst parts of America. And even though that they are at many levels evil, they've managed to package it in a very American pie way. Warren Buffett does the same thing. Man, I don't trust the guy, but the guy aw shucks it his way to the richest guy in the world. And guess what his biggest position is? Apple, right? Whereas Carl Icahn, it took until he was 90 for you to do a documentary where you go, all right, I can put up with the guy because he was an ass. So really good take. I'm going to end it on that. I want to bring you back to talk about micromobility, hopefully, you know, sometime this summer. But
yeah,
everybody
let's
can
do
know
that because it, I think that's yeah. Like a whole hour. And you know, it's similar low end stuff, and I'd like to get everybody excited about that.
Well, I think now you've got some different types of fans. And when I think of micromobility, and you know, bicycle, because I'm a cyclist, and I love brands, and I love humor, and taking a piss out of myself. Does Apple get into the bicycle eventually ahead of the car?
This is exactly to your question. It's almost a litmus test. If you're today thinking about transportation, maybe you're not going to get it for a couple of years.
No, I'm all in on bike. I'm making investments in the industry. Like it's a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, but it may still be too early. But I'll say this much. I mean, the e-bike world is exploding. The scooter world is exploding. There are hundreds of millions of people using these things already. Yeah. They're not smart yet, and Apple needs to get there. Now, they could go in through wearables because I think we're going to be wearing smart helmets. We're going to be wearing watches, which will help us in our journey and so on. And
yep.
So there's a bunch of stuff that's coming that will be enabling a new era. Already, it's being enabled by compute, and it's enabled by lithium batteries and by 3G, 4G, 5G, and all those other things.
The only thing that interests me as I get older is I ride the mountains and see 70-year-old people go by me in an electric bike on the same mountain. There's nothing wrong with that. They get to now see it the way I get to see it. Who cares how much energy you're doing to go up, but at least you're in the same surroundings. So it's a foregone conclusion. It's the question of who wins this race. Is it Tesla? Is it Apple? Who really makes the move and owns micromobility? So I will bring you back. Now, for people to find you, what's the best way to engage with you?
It's Twitter. It's @AsymCo, A-S-Y-M-C-O. Love to see you there. I'm on it all day long, every day. If there's mentions, I try to always reply. You can also visit me at micromobility.io. That is the website where we talk micromobility, asymco.com. That is my blog. And we have a podcast, which is currently under the paid domain of Apple Podcasts. But if you are really interested in hearing me talk for more than an hour, then you can go to the Asymmetric podcast. And that's Asymmetric with only one M on purpose. And that's on Apple Podcasts. I think there's another one where you don't have to go through Apple. But anyway, you'll Google it and figure it out.
All right, everybody. Horace, great to finally connect. We'll do it again. And really, thanks for just keeping me focused on the good side of this trend, because it's easy to get sidetracked. So great work, and I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, and let's keep going, man. Let's make progress.
All right. Take care. Jensen.
Hey, Mr. Linson.
Fun.
Yeah.
Deep.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to let everybody go, but... thanks for listening. Really, really worth a lightweight follow and go as deep as you want with Horace. I've been doing it for 15 years. That's what we do here. We talk to smart people you might not have heard of, some you have heard of. Big thinkers, people who want to stay ahead of the curve, easy to find, not expensive. Our job, talk to these people, spot trends, find them, ride them, and hopefully make a few dollars along the way. Well, you are listening to Panic with Friends. Search my name, Howard Linzen, on Google, Apple, Spotify. Panic with Friends, subscribe. You'll get one of these a week. Tell your friends. Thanks, Knut. See everybody next week.
Howard Linzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.